Delicious spring gatherings start at Whole Foods Market. Shop the spring and bloom sales event with yellow sales signs throughout the store. And serve your loved ones Whole Foods Market seafood, always responsibly farmed or sustainable wild caught. Explore vibrant seasonal flavors like their trending mango yuzu chantilly cake. Great for brunch or an after dinner treat. Speaking of brunch, check out their deviled eggs, cold pressed juices, and more. Spring is in bloom now at Whole Foods Market.
The new Gum Health Hero is here from Parodontax, the experts in gum care. Parodontax gums strengthen and protect, strengthens the gum seal by killing plaque bacteria along the gum line for a stronger and tighter seal between the gums and teeth. Clinically proven to reduce bleeding. And now with hyaluronic acid for foaming action. Brush and rinse twice daily to protect against plaque, keep gums tight, and enjoy long-lasting gum health. Parodontax. Strong gums. Healthy smile.
Welcome to The Tower, a podcast that explores the films that took the rulebook, doused it in gasoline, and lit a match. The Tower tarot card represents chaos and the upheaval of old forms. And here, I will focus on films that did just that for my brilliant guests. The films that changed them forever are films that belong in The Tower. In each episode, I interview visionaries in cinema, from directors to festival programmers, from actors to writers, and we explore their favorite paradigm-shifting films. The fire's burning. Come dance with us in the flames. Welcome to The Tower. Today, I have writer, director, producer, Jen Wexler. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Emily. How's it going?
Good. And just to introduce you to people listening, you are formerly a producer with Glass Eye Picks, or maybe currently, are you still producing for them?
I came up through Glass Eye Picks. I produced several movies with them, but we still work together from time to time in different capacities. And yes, then also directed a film called The Ranger with them, and then directed a film called The Sacrifice Game.
Two incredible films. You've been so prolific as a producer of Depraved, Most Beautiful Island, Like Me, Darling, and Psychopaths. But I know you mostly from your directing work for, like you said, The Ranger, The Sacrifice Game, which was so incredible and sweeping and 70s. Vibed. It's just so darkly magical. And obviously, coming from Glass Eye, with your love for genre and horror, I was so excited to have you on the podcast, mostly because I was like, I wonder what Jen is going to pick. You're so iconic in the horror space. I feel like you're so well known in the industry. And when you told me your Tower film, I was really surprised and intrigued. And I had never seen this film before. So I'd love to just open it up to you. In thinking about your Tower film, what did you consider before you told me your title?
I think when you first told me about the podcast, you phrased it like, what is a movie that transformed how you view cinema? And that question alone, like, it came pretty instantly to me. Of course, I could go back to when I was younger and there were a lot of movies that made me fall in love with cinema and that made me want to be a director. And we could talk about some of those too, and the movies that made me fall in love with the horror genre. But this is a movie that I saw, even though it came out quite a while ago, I saw it pretty recently, and I saw it after I'd directed films, and it really like affected the way that I view cinema and filmmaking. So the movie is Bob Fosse's All That Jazz.
Thank you so much for finally being the impetus for me to see this film. This was an unbelievable watch. So thank you so much for suggesting this film.
It's a hard movie to watch right now because it's not streaming anywhere. You have to like buy the Blu-ray, which is an amazing Blu-ray purchase for those of you out there interested in buying it. I think it's on Criterion, yeah. Although it's not on the Criterion channel. But I saw it only like a year and a half ago, and I saw it because it was playing IFC Center in New York, and my husband was like, he just bought the tickets and was like, we're going to see this. And I should offer a little bit of backstory in that when I was younger, when I was a teenager, I was in high school at the time that Chicago, the movie, came out. And that's a fun movie, but I really disliked it because it changed, like all the musical theater kids, all my friends, all the musical theater kids in my class were constantly singing Chicago songs. And then Bob Fosse just became synonymous for me with like Broadway, like annoying jazz hands that I was constantly surrounded by, in theater class. And I think that around that time was like the Fosse Review that was on Broadway, you know, being a teenager that was like into horror movies. And I thought that's what was cool. I kind of just wrote off everything related to Bob Fosse. I was like, I don't want to know about this. I'm not into musicals, whatever. And that's where it was. It was just like sitting in a file cabinet in my mind, closed for years and years. So even when my husband bought us these tickets like a year and a half ago, I was like, okay, fine, let's go see this. And then I saw it and I was watching it, and it was just, you know, one of those movie watching experiences where you're in it immediately. Mm. I was in it immediately and I was captivated for the full 2.5 hours or however long it is. With a lot of movies, I find myself, you know, I'm thinking about how they're doing it. I'm in, but then I'm also out, and I'm not fully in the world of it. And this is one of those rare viewing experiences where I was just like, I don't think I blinked the entire time I was watching it. I was just like fully in it every moment. It was just amazing. So I'd seen Cabaret, but I went back to Cabaret and I was like, oh, this is also a masterpiece. Obviously, it was also like won a bunch of Oscars. Like, I'm not the first person to think that, obviously. So I went back to Cabaret, like found a new fondness for that, went back to Sweet Charity, like watched, actually my husband and I like just went on a Fosse bender and we watched every single one of his movies. And then we watched the Fosse Verdon TV show. And it was like a month of where like all I wanted to do was think about Bob Fosse. So
I love that so much because I too suffered under the jazz hands of my peers growing up, especially being an actor in New York City. I just hated going to Ripley Greer audition spaces where everything was, because it was constantly, I went to drama school, I went to an arts boarding school, and I quickly became very soured against musical theater. I became very cynical because of my peers, because they just, you're right, they want to sing these songs just full blast together, and you're like, I can't deal with this mob of happy jazz hands. I'm like, ugh. And I mean, I think you and I were pretty similar growing up. Like, I was a bit shoegazy. I was a bit like alt. Like, I wanted to find something that felt special and cool and different. And I don't know. And I don't want to say that's how you were, but that's certainly how I was.
I was like, no, like punk rock is my thing. I'm going to punk shows. I'm not going to like, you know, join in with you while we sing the greatest hits from Chicago.
Yeah, it felt not genuine to me in a lot of ways. And growing up trying to become an actor, I was constantly trying to find my truth and where reality, where truth telling, where honesty was living in me and in different characters. And all of that felt like window dressing. And then especially I went to RADA, and we had to do a musical in our final year, and we did Little Women the musical. And I remember just being like, I hate this. I never want to do this again. I did order the Criterion Blu-ray. I highly recommend. And I put it in and I totally agree with you. I don't know that I blinked the entire time.
Yeah. It's amazing from opening to closing images.
Yeah.
I felt like I had heard it was one of Stanley Kubrick's favorite films. And there's a line in the movie where he's like, does Stanley Kubrick ever get depressed? So then I just like really quick, actually, before this call, I just like Googled it. Like, was this something I made up or is this real? And then actually, if anybody wants to go look, there's an IndieWire article that's like, it's not just Kubrick's favorite film, but like Martin Scorsese's and David Fincher's, like so many amazing filmmakers like put this towards the top of their list.
Yeah, you are among the greats to recommend this film. And Kubrick actually did tell Fosse later that he loved the film, which meant a huge deal to Bob Fosse. And I mean, if Kubrick likes it, I think you're doing something pretty good.
So my two favorite films of all time now are The Shining and All That Jazz. So I was going to give you one of those to talk about. It was either going to be The Shining or All That Jazz, but...
I'm so glad you did this one because it selfishly for me, it allowed me into a world I had never seen or experienced before. So that said, let's dive in. For anyone who hasn't seen it, I'm going to read the log line. So this is from IMDb. Director choreographer Bob Fosse tells his own life story as he details the sordid career of Joe Gideon, a womanizing, drug-using dancer. And even reading that log line before I watched the movie, I was like, okay, well, what happens? because typically in log lines, you're like two characters going through something, encounter an obstacle, and da-da-da. And the log line for this seemed to be almost open-ended. I didn't quite know what I was going to experience going into it. And from the first frame, I have to say, Bob Fosse is an incredible director. And his editor, Alan Heim, unreal editing in this film. I honestly, since Don't Look Now, I have not experienced editing like this. That is just so artful and propulsive and staggering and off-putting. So yeah, I mean, why don't you take us into kind of the very beginning of this film? Because there's kind of two openings, right?
Well, yeah. So I mean... going back to the log line, it does sound kind of small just from the log line, or for somebody who hasn't seen it, if you're like, oh, yes, it's about the life and inner workings of, and the life and mind of this choreographer and director. But it's actually so huge. To me, it feels like as epic as 2001, but going inside a person, going into their consciousness. And
that's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. But it feels like as epic to me as 2001, going back to Kubrick as well. And so, yes, the very beginning, you know, it's day in the life of Joe Gideon, director, choreographer, director of Broadway shows and as well as movies. And I would say the first half of the film is playing with more realism, some fly on the wall stuff, how this director like lives his life every day. And the very first sequence of the film, I believe, is him like getting ready for the day. He, you know, a lot of people associate the phrase like it's showtime with this movie. And that's because that's the phrase he kind of says to himself in the mirror every day. And to me, the it's showtime phrase is really him getting ready to put on the face he has to show to the outside world, the face that he has to show to like pump everybody up. And as a director, you really know the feeling of, okay, you have all the things on your mind, all the things you're pissed off about, all your insecurities, all the things you're worrying about. But to the everybody you're going to talk to that day, like your energy is what's going to lead them through the day. They're going to be reacting and they're going to be acting and reacting based off the energy that you're giving them. So that all is really like succinctly expressed to me via the it's showtime moments that happen over the course of the movie.
Totally agree. And yeah, the quick cutting, we are immediately thrust into his mind. I love what you said about 2001, because that film explores outer space so well. And you're right, this is exploring inner space just so fully, that we wake up in the morning with him. And some of these things might sound cliche, and they are not in any way here. I think as directors, I've personally seen a lot of like alarm clocks go off and eggs going into a frying pan and someone dragging themselves out of bed. But this is so fresh and different. We encounter Joe Gideon getting up in the morning, Alka-Seltzer in the glass of water, Dexedrine, I think, is the drug he takes, which is a kind of speed. And it's just these quicker cuts of what is his morning, what face does he have to put on in the morning? And yeah, that looking in the mirror, it's showtime. I mean, as a director, I know that feeling of like, okay, you gotta get your stuff together today to go to set. And yeah, and then we're immediately thrust into this huge audition, right?
I mean, yeah, it's an audition for the new show. And what do you think? As somebody, have you auditioned for theater like that? Have you ever been part of those mass auditions?
I definitely have. I haven't typically gone up for musical theater like this. And I would never claim to be a dancer. I'm an actor who moves well, but I would never claim to be a dancer. But it does remind me, I went in for Sleep No More, the show that's been going on in New York City, that Punch Drunk has done, and it's the big Macbeth, but 20s themed. I was called to audition with a huge group of people, I remember. And we went through several mass auditions, and the final was in this huge room. I did not get the job, spoiler, but I was in this huge room with people, and we were told to kind of explore the room like animals. And it was me and like 50 other people in this giant room with very dim lighting, just kind of crawling and rolling on the ground. Like, and I don't know, it felt like drama school, like be a tree. and so we were, but it was just bodies kind of rolling around and climbing around each other. That's probably the closest that I've gotten to this much more elegant audition that he's holding.
Yeah, I mean, in this, first of all, it captures everything that I feel, like the aesthetic of late 70s New York City Broadway world. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole movie, but also this opening sequence, like fully captures what I believe that was like. I wasn't around then. Yeah. And it expresses so much from like the hopefulness of the dancers and how these people are like really trained, like they're really good, but yeah. Also like, you know, the stress that he's under to choose the right people, the interdynamics between the producers and the songwriter who wants a soprano and, you know, his wife and daughter who are watching from the audience. So it's introducing all of these characters. It's expressing the power that he wields over the dancers as he kind of like flirts with people as he's like deciding who he wants, but also the like it's a big job and a big responsibility and it's like fully on his shoulders. And it also is expressing his like deteriorating health right from the beginning. So it's just a pretty incredible opening sequence that like lays the groundwork for the whole world that we're in.
Initially, I did read that that Bob Fosse was going to cut the initial beginning of this film when he's waking up and simply go into this massive audition sequence, but his creative team really encouraged him to keep the beginning. So I'm really glad that he kept both of these, because you see both sides of his public life and his private life.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think one of the things I love about this movie, this is truly like the reason why it's one of my favorite movies of all time, is it's a movie about control. And it's a movie, like the whole movie, the character is, I mean, by the way, spoiler alert for people who haven't watched it yet. I mean, this whole episode is probably full of spoilers. So,
yeah.
Just saying. But the whole movie, he wants to control everything. And that comes out in so many ways, definitely over the course of the first half of the film when he's struggling for creative control. And then ultimately, the film is about like, yeah, at the end of the day, you don't have control over anything. And it's a movie about a person who has to come to terms with that. And I think that you can see that throughout. It's constant throughout the film. But certainly in the beginning, like it sets that journey up really beautifully.
I totally agree. That idea of control, I relate to so deeply. And the meta qualities of this film are just everywhere, because even in you saying this is about the fact that he doesn't ultimately have control, Bob Fosse is exploring, narrating his life and the end of his life, and in a way controlling the narrative of that within the film as well. So even in showing how little control he has, I feel like Fosse is still taking a bit of control in saying, no, but I'm going to tell this story and this is how I'm going to tell it, right?
Totally. I mean, this was like, I believe it was inspired by a time in between when he was finishing editing Lenny and while he was getting ready for directing Chicago, the play.
Yeah.
And he had a heart attack. And so the movie is literally about that time in his life. Mm. And yeah, that is really fun to think about that his way of exerting control, even though in the movie, the character relinquishes control, learns, you know, what really matters in life. The idea that Bob Fosse, the man, ultimately made a movie about it as another form of trying to gain control over the universe.
I mean, I kind of love that too. I have some OCD qualities, especially when it comes to work, kind of over professionalism and making sure I'm checking all my boxes. And I completely relate to his desire to tell a story about losing control with the utmost control and craft. And it did make me want to ask you, kind of backing up from this film, Jen, would you ever make your own All That Jazz, your own life or death opus film, as it were?
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, will I ever, or do I want to? The answer is yes, I want to. I also love 8 and a Half. Like, I've loved 8 and a Half since I was 20 years old, seeing it in film school. And it was like, that was another transformative, life-changing film. So 100%, you know, we'll see if that ever happens. But yes, I would love to.
No, I'm so glad you said yes. And it makes me wonder, obviously, Fellini's 8 and a Half was a huge influence in All That Jazz. It's a mirror upon the filmmaker kind of commenting and controlling sections of his life and showing them. I feel like both have such playfulness about them, and yet they go into realms that aren't necessarily all in reality. And I really love that. It makes me want to ask you just one follow-up question. What would you see your kind of opus film being like? Because obviously with All That Jazz, it takes place very much on a movie set, a movie editing room, a Broadway stage, and a hospital. Would your life be a movie set? What would that kind of look like? Just, I'm curious.
Well, So I've actually already written, I've already written a screenplay that I will say takes great influence from Eight and a Half and all that jazz. But I don't want to go too deep into it in this conversation, but I'll just say that I've thought deeply about this. And something I really appreciate from this movie and from Eight and a Half, or something that's always been interesting to me, is that it's about a person, a character at the center of it, and all of their relationships and how those distinctive relationships then inform the person's art. And so that's a feature that I am really attracted to and that I have incorporated into this script I'm working on.
Oh, I love that. As we continue through all that jazz, we should mention Roy Scheider is playing the lead role here of Joe Gideon. And he is so charismatic in this film. The casting process was really interesting for this because they initially were going out to so many different people were approached for this role. Initially, they approached Richard Dreyfuss was supposed to play this role. And it's funny that they're both in Jaws together. But Roy Scheider, he admittedly, he was like, I cannot sing, I cannot dance. And Bob Fosse for a little while was like, I don't know how this person is going to play me. And I'm sure it was kind of an ego reckoning with Bob Fosse, who was obviously an incredible dancer. But there is something so magical about Roy Scheider in this film. I mean, what are your thoughts on his performance?
I mean, I think he's amazing. I think that a lot of the way that I think of Bob Fosse, even though I've watched interviews with Bob Fosse and whatnot, like I think of Bob Fosse as Roy Scheider because of this movie.
Yeah.
In my head, they are one. Whether that's ultimately fair or correct or not, that's what's in my head. I mean, he knows. I mean, Fosse knows part of why he wrote this script. Like, he's not like a good guy all the time. That's part of the point of the movie. There's some like, there's a lot of sexism throughout. There's some like light sexual harassment throughout. And yet, you know, this care, and maybe this isn't a good thing, you know, in the year of our Lord 2025, but there's like, he's super charming. You still like him, even though it's like, dude, don't grab the nurse's ass. Like, don't do that. And yet you're like, aw, Joe Gideon, you rascal, you. So I don't know. But yeah, the performance is so charming and he's so charismatic and amazing.
I think the one redeeming thing about him is that none of his advances seem unwelcome necessarily.
Everybody loves his advances. Yes. Everyone is like, oh my God, yeah, I want to like sleep with my boss in his hospital room while, you know, the assistant editor girl.
I know. Like, oh my God. We begin with this Broadway opening, and then we just see his encounters with various women. He is constantly, Bob Fosse is constantly giving himself the compliment of everyone loves me, everyone wants me.
So his girlfriend, Anne Rankin, is literally on set of his movie. He's interested in Jessica Lange, like in real life. Yeah. He's interested in Jessica Lange also. You know, he was married to Gwen Verdon, and that's who the character Audrey is based on. And she's part of the reason he is who he is. And and their relationship was obviously pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I said. That, like, going back to the fact that he's like, it's a movie about a person with a lot of relationships and how all those relationships like interconnect with each other and interconnect with his his creative subconscious.
It's so vulnerable and exposing. As much as we're joking that, you know, he's casting himself as this ladies' man, I mean, he was. And it's kind of amazing how much of an open book this is into his mind and his fear of death and his approach to his art. It's a very brave film in that way.
Well, because it's also, it's super self-reflective and self-demeaning also. Like,
yeah,
he knows he's been an asshole, and he carries like a lot of guilt around with him. And I think that that's a lot of what the film is about. Going back to the, because I think this is all really interconnected, going back to the idea of control, there's a line early in the film, to be on the wire is life, the rest is waiting. So that's early in the film, and he's like literally on a tightrope in that otherworldly place they keep cutting back to throughout. Mm. And that resonates with me so much. I think like a lot of artists and filmmakers relate with this. To be on the wire is life, the rest is waiting. When you're making a movie or working on a project, it feels like life takes on, like, it feels big, it feels important, it feels like you have purpose, it feels like the world surrounds you and you are so important, and the rest is waiting is like in between those projects. Mm. It feels like life is nothing. It's just, you're literally just waiting for the next important moment again, the next project. And I think it's just really beautiful that like literally that's how the film begins. And throughout the first half of the film, he, you know, doesn't have, he is the most important person. He doesn't have time. Like, his art is the most important thing. And all these people are kind of like second to that and his ego. And then the end of the film, during the Bye Bye Life number, mm-hmm. He's realized that that's not what's important, and that life is all of the people along the way and all of the experiences along the way and all these people who are in the audience seeing him off. I mean, that's also kind of egocentric that all these people are like watching his show, but still there is growth there.
Yeah. No, I that quote was so chilling at the very beginning, because I fully agree with you. Work is so important to me, and I know it is to you too, that I do have to remind myself it's not all. It's not all there is, because when you're passionate about making films or when you're passionate about doing anything in the arts, I feel like some people, I know I have this, I have a bit of a tunnel vision, and I gain so much joy from creating that the rest does sometimes feel like waiting. And you're right, the tragedy of that very end, which in itself, you're right, is so ironic that it is a show that he's putting on for his loved ones, but he is finally going into the audience rather than being on stage and recognizing that it was the people along the way.
I think that it's kind of a, I don't know if I view it as a tragedy. I view it as like, he's finally full. He's finally like, he's no longer wanting at the end. Like, he realizes he has everything and he's always had everything. He's no longer yearning like he was earlier.
Mm. No, I love that reading of it. By our different perceptions of that final film, and I'm going to watch it again now, like thinking about it in the way that you've just spoken, I love how much of a Rorschach test this film is for people, because I think we all, because he is so vulnerable and an open book in this film, I think we are all able to come to it with our own stories.
Totally.
You know? And I think that it reminds me of art and film. The more specific you are, the more universal it can be.
Totally.
You know?
100%.
And I think because he is so specific and exacting about the actual drug that he took to wake up in the morning. That was like the address on the bottle is like the address right next to his address. on Central Park, he is so specific and exhaustive about, this is what I took to wake up in the morning. This was the audition. This is what I did. This is who I slept with in the afternoon. Then my girlfriend came home and then I saw my daughter. And my only way to relate to my daughter is in this dance hall where we're going through choreography together. He is very specific. And
that scene is so beautiful, by the way.
Yeah, it's the one relationship in this film that doesn't feel fraught with him wanting something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
His relationship with his daughter is so beautiful.
And it's interesting that all of his relationships are via dance. Like, they, you know, you have the scene with her, the father-daughter scene where they're having... He's doing work while he's spending time with his daughter, which is he's working out moves while he's using her to do it. But she like doesn't mind. She like likes it. I mean, she's having fun hanging out with her dad. And then skipping ahead, the scene with Anne Rankin and his daughter putting on a show for him. It's like, you know, in some families you show, it's like their love language. Their love language is like dancing for each other. But a scene I want to talk about, a sequence I want to talk about, because I think it's really, I mean, this whole movie, part of the reason why I love this movie so much is that it's so much about the creative process. And I love how in the film, at first, he hates the song he's forced to choreograph this number for. You can tell when the guy is singing it, he like is annoyed by it. He thinks it's cheesy. He like dislikes it, but the producers all love it. And then he's trying to figure it out. He has like director's block, choreographer's block while he's choreographing it with the dancers and taking it out on them in different ways. And there's a great moment where they all look at him like, what should we do? Was that good? And he like doesn't even know how to look at them. Mm. Anyway, going back to the way that the dance is such a part of his family's love language. Then there's this scene with his wife. Well, I mean, they're still married, but ex, Audrey, who is the star of this show that they're putting on. And via dance, they're talking about their relationship and fidelity versus infidelity and the people that he's cheated on her with. Mm. And there's a moment in that conversation, she keeps referencing some blonde from Philadelphia that he cheated on with, and he can't even remember her name and doesn't care. But then there's a moment in there where you can just see like the light switch go off in his head. She says, Dorothy, her name was Dorothy. Mm. And then the next scene you see is the scene that they're putting on the performance for the producers to watch. And now the song that was so bad in his head before, he's turned it into this like super hot, sexy orgy number. And after that, Audrey is crying. And she's like, that's like the best thing you've ever choreographed. And I hate you. And I hate you because I'm realizing that the thing that inspired you and got rid of your director's block was like sex with other women and you cheating on me and Dorothy. Like she puts those pieces together. And it is, again, going back to like the different relationships in this movie and how they affect his art. And then like, you know, if you're an artist, how real life then affects your art. And how your subconscious is working through things when you feel like you're stuck, like you're working on a totally different layer and level, and how the answer sometimes feels like it appears out of thin air, but really it's like, no, there's all these inner workings that the back of your mind is constantly doing. Anyway, I just like talked about a whole lot of parts of this movie all at once, but I think that they're all tied together. And I think it's fucking awesome. That's part of why I love this movie so much, that it's so relatable in that way.
No, that was so well said. And that scene between he and his ex-wife, played by Leland Palmer, which took me back for a second because that's a character on Twin Peaks, but that's her real name. But that scene between them as exes, him not remembering Dorothy, this blonde that he cheated on her with. And you're right, then we go into the sequence called Erotica, which is the most beautiful, hot, subversive. It still feels dangerous. These bodies looking like they're molding and having sex and this orgy that's going on. And yeah, his ex-wife looks at him and knows, I feel like the reason that she is so crushed and has tears in her eyes is she's almost saying it was worth it.
Oh, that's interesting.
I wonder, like, what do you get from that? Because she is so transcendent in this role, in this film. She's so vulnerable and so hurt. And that moment, what do you think she's saying right there?
I think she's saying, I'm acknowledging you being which she perceives as an asshole towards her. Like, you cheating on me and destroying our marriage is helping you make great art. And I love you because I love your art and because I love you, but I also hate you. And I hate that that's where this is coming from. I mean, it's so many extreme emotions put into, and it's a pretty, it's like, I don't know, 20 seconds. It's like a pretty short shot. And this is right after the producers have been like, we don't like this. It's way too sexy for our show. And he goes over to her and he's like, well, what did you think? Mm. And she just looks up at him with these tears. But that's why, like, their relationship is so, and it is my understanding is that Gwen Verdon and Bob Fosse's relationship was like this. Like, they didn't stay in their traditional marriage, but they were like best friends and understood each other creatively, like unlike anybody else could, and like pushed each other creatively. And like, I don't know. I think it, and then later in the movie when Audrey is like always by his bedside and always there and kind of like trying to keep the rest of the theater troupe, the rest of the performers like inspired and like, he's going to be back soon. Like, you know, she was like the character is like Joe Gideon's biggest supporter, even though they have such a fraught history with each other.
Yeah. And I love your reading of that moment. And I love that you highlighted their relationship because it's so full, even at the point when he has his heart attack in this film because he's overworking himself and being pulled in so many different directions, directing a Broadway show, editing a film at night. They're over budget and Bob Fosse was taking too long. And so Joe Gideon and Bob Fosse are experiencing the same things in life. And then he ultimately, in the film, has a heart attack and goes into the hospital. And yet, Audrey Paris, his ex-wife, this character we've been talking about, she is heartbroken in the hospital, crying with him. And yet we cut back to the same rehearsal hall. And she's like, oh, he's cracking jokes and he can't wait to be back. And, you know, he's coming up with a new hospital number. And the pianist is like, oh, does it sound a little like this? And they start to kind of create, and she cheers everyone up in the room to keep spirits alive and to keep that energy going. She's so selfless in this film. It's so heartbreaking.
Yeah. But the movie at first tries to make her seem selfish.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, actually, she's really cool. And and you can kind of tell, like, you know, their love is more, is beyond, like I said, traditional husband-wife marriage. It's like she's just, you know, she's like his collaborator. She's supportive of him. it doesn't seem like she's harboring any resentment at this point towards Kate Jagger and Ranking, his girlfriend. It seems like when they're in the hospital room together, they're like all there for him because they all love him. I don't sense any, at that point, any kind of like jealousy or anything between those two.
Yeah, I don't either, which I feel like is pretty progressive in a lot of ways. Because I feel like, each relationship looks different. And this is his relationship with all of these people in his life. I have to back up and ask you just kind of a broader question about what we just talked about. Do you think all of the drinking, womanizing, if all of that led to the art that Bob Fosse created, was it worth it, in your opinion?
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, not, okay, I'll say, like, I don't know the super personal stuff of Bob Fosse's life. I've never read a biography about him. I, like, certainly never knew anybody who knew him personally.
Yeah.
I'll say that my life belief is, as an artist, like, adventures help create your art. Like, I'm very pro-adventure if it's going to help your art. Now, I want to draw a hard line in the sand that's like, that doesn't mean doing things that people don't want you to do to them. I'm not excusing, like, sexual assault or harassment or any of that for any, you know, other filmmakers that we know about.
Yeah.
But as long as everybody is like a willing party to the experience, then yes, I am all about, you know, go for it, have fun and see how that affects your art.
I fully agree. It's so many artists that I love. I mean, it's messy being an artist. And I agree. Do no harm. Do, like, none of that. Nothing is ever excusable if you're actively trying to hurt someone else. Cruelty is not excusable, but lives are messy and relationships are messy and life is beautiful and bizarre. And I totally agree. I think these adventures, he's not like the guy who's at home, like, cooking dinner and faithful to his wife. This is the shape of his life, and this is the shape of the people in his life. And it's, yeah, I mean, just once again, it's so vulnerable and so giving to show us all the his life, warts and all, including these very special relationships. But they, I don't know, it makes me really understand him a lot better. We have to talk about Jessica Lange a little bit in here, because we continue, as we go through his secular life, what's happening day to day, even up until his heart attack, we continue cutting back to this, what looks like an abandoned stage. And this woman, Jessica Lange, who is credited, her character is credited as Angelique. And she is a kind of beautiful, white, gauzy death character talking to him, right? Is that your reading of it?
Yeah, she's, although we don't know it quite at first, she's like Angel of Death.
Yeah. And he is having this dialogue with her throughout the film that we continue cutting back to. And she's so beautiful and chilling that I think this was her second film. And he's almost bragging about every aspect of his life, all the womanizing, all the drinking, all the drugs, all the overwork, the even laughing at the doctors who tell him he needs to stop, as if he's going to pull the wool over their eyes and, like, continue hurting himself, as if that's hurting anyone but himself. But she finds this all very amusing, and she almost encourages it, which it made me think, Jen, like, I feel like death would appreciate bad behavior. Or like death would appreciate anything that would push you closer to her in a way.
Yeah, I think she's like making him reflect. Mm. And at first he thinks he's in control of all of that. And then he slowly realizes, you know, then he's reflecting things on things that are painful and hard. At first he has a bit of an ego about it. And then over the course of the film, he's getting more, you know, again, he's losing control and we're meeting the real him. I really like this technique though. And I noticed that Bob Fosse did it in Cabaret and in Lenny, of having this, intercutting back to a thing. So here we keep intercutting back to his conversations with the Angel of Death. In Lenny, we keep going back to his stand-up routine. And in Cabaret, we keep going back to the Kit Kat Club. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a cool editing technique that makes everything feel a little subjective. It plays around with time. You can still be linear in your time, but then you're also non-linear because you keep coming back to something that's going to be important ultimately. And, you know, over the course of this film, you certainly discover why this place is important.
Yeah, that's so well said. She's not pushing back on anything he's telling her kind of very boldly. And I feel like the fact that she's not putting up any obstacles or arguing like, oh, you shouldn't have cheated on these people. I think the fact that she isn't pushing, there's nothing to push back against anymore. I think that in a way softens him as we move toward the end.
She's kind of his like dream woman. Mm-hmm. Throughout the movie, we keep hearing about the blonde from Philadelphia. Mm. My own reading of that is that she, Jessica Lange's character, he fashioned the way she looks, the way he imagines her to look, off of this blonde from Philadelphia. Like, I think the blonde from Philadelphia looked like Jessica Lange. And then, yeah. Because why else was it like her? I think that was what she looks like. And then in his head, you know, in this moment between life and death, he's given the Angel of Death all of her qualities.
Oh, I love that reading. That hadn't occurred to me, but I love, that's amazing. Yeah. And then the narrative is so strong. I never lost the thread of jumping back and forth. You're right. It is still linear. And, you know, we move into this longer, the end of the film is mostly taking place in the hospital. Him kind of, it becomes a bit disjointed in a way, and it's a little hard to remember exactly what happens step after step as he continues to get worse in the hospital. He has all of these odd encounters with people. He wanders through the hallways and hangs out and sings with someone working there. And
that guy, by the way, my reading is that guy's not really there. That's like a figure from his Showtime-y past when he was a kid, somebody he like saw on TV or something. And because when those other guys come, those other hospital workers come to grab him, nobody looks at the janitor. Nobody looks at the janitor. So I think the janitor is in his head and he's sitting there by himself.
I totally agree with you. That occurred when I was watching that. I was like, that guy's not there.
Yeah.
Yeah. He also goes into a woman's room that doesn't look quite real. Certain hospital corridors feel real and grounded, but certain rooms and certain pockets of this hospital feel like they're on a stage with intense darkness surrounding them at all sides. And he goes into this room with this woman, this older woman, and he kisses her. and all the sound goes out. And before we talk about that, the other time all of the sound goes out is when he's having his heart attack in the rehearsal room, or he's about to have a heart attack and all of the sound drops out there as well. And I love this technique, and I'd love to just talk about what is your reading of this woman, this older woman in the hospital bed when all of the sound goes out?
Well, first of all, during the table read, when the sound goes out, that's an incredible moment. I think these are two distinctive moments, like two separate moments that he used the same technique for both of them. Right. But it's going back to like how this movie is about the creative process. When I first saw that scene, when I was first watching the movie and I saw that scene, that like took my breath away, because it was like, he's having a panic attack about how this is reading, how the script is reading. Yeah. Everybody loves the script, but he knows that like it's broken and it's not there yet. And I think it kind of works both ways. I think that scene works if you're thinking about it in those terms of like what it feels like when creatively something's not right, but you're the only person that sees that the thing's not right and everybody else is going along like it's great. Yeah. But then I also think it works as, you know, these are the moments before he's about to have his big heart attack, which lands him in the hospital. So I think it works on both levels.
Yeah, totally. And then he brings that sound design element in again with this older woman in the hospital. Do you think that's his indication of life draining there?
I felt that was kind of a moment. He says to her something like, you're the most beautiful thing. And I think it's somebody that previously he would have been like, you're an old lady, like, no, I'm not interested in you, I'm not sexually attracted to you, and that's all that mattered to him. And in this moment, it's like another example of how he's seeing beyond the surface level. He's seeing like what matters in life, and he's seeing the beauty of this person who's like about to die, and moving past, you know, who he was previously, and he's like kind of helping this woman move to the other side. Like that's what he's taken on that role. Now, is that lady even there? I don't know. I think that's also part of another part of his ego, where like, oh, by kissing her, he's going to help her like pass gently into the afterlife. Like that's a little egocentric too. But I think it has to do with all of that. That's my reading.
No, and I know those were two kind of different questions. I just wanted to highlight both of those very subjective moments. And thank you for picking those apart. I love that reading that the older woman isn't necessarily there, or that he is seeing someone in reality and now finding her beautiful.
We were talking about sound and how the sound goes out, but in general, I think the soundscape is so awesome and smart. So the film that he's editing is called The Stand-Up, and that's supposed to be like in real life, Fosse was editing Lenny at this time, which is about a stand-up comedian, Lenny Bruce. Mm. So there, the part of the movie we see him editing is about the five stages of death. It's a comedy routine, stand-up routine about the five stages of death. And at first we just see, you know, Gideon being annoyed. He can't get it right. It's not funny. Everybody else thinks it's good, but he thinks it still sucks. So we replay it a couple of times as he's trying to like change the speed, change the order, and so on. But then it starts to come into the soundscape in ways that are unexpected. You cut back to it at certain moments, and to me, that's like he's starting to sense his world is starting to come apart, and he's starting to sense that something is not right deep down in himself. And then in the second half of the film, really, it's like he wants to deny that he's having any health issues. And then in the second half of the film, this part of the stand-up routine keeps coming back in the soundscape. And then you're like, oh, I mean, that's part of what this movie is about. It's like a man going through the five stages of death, like, you know, denial, anger, depression, all those. I don't know the order, but all of those. And I think that it's really an effective way and feels super like organic and holistic to the entire movie that you set that up early on. And then it's literally playing in the soundscape when he's like running through hospital corridors and he can't escape.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought that up because initially he's kind of making fun of the stages of grief and the stages of death. And yet it continues to play in his mind. And for the audience, as he's going through the stages himself of grieving his own life.
Yeah.
Because it rings at first, it rings so kind of funny in this stand-up edit. We hear it. It's a bit, you know, it's a fine stand-up. And we're maybe paying attention to it initially. But when it repeats later, as we're seeing different stages of his life and moving into death, it... Yeah, the repetition of that is just so powerful and emotional because I feel like we're starting to grieve his life with him.
And it's also so, like, when you're editing a film, you go through these periods of, like thinking through, wait, how is this best? How should we best cut it? Oh, what if I trim a little bit here? What if we extend this? And it's kind of like this process is haunting him. Mm. It's playing in his subconscious and he like can't shut it off. And it's haunting him later too. And I think that, again, that's so cool how like all the different parts of his life are coming through as he's going through these different moments, first of trying to direct a show and then of dying.
Yeah, it's like his life is flashing before his eyes and his ears, I guess, that he's reliving these things that he is able to see in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I see films and they just seem so perfect. It's almost difficult to pick them apart. And I feel like this is one of those films that I can't wait to like continue rewatching this because I envy you having seen it so many times because I feel like there's so many things that I missed I love talking to you about this film because I'm now able to kind of put into words exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's one of my favorites, which is like you can watch it endlessly and you keep picking up new stuff and having new insights about it. And it's also kind of, based on what you're going through in your own life, too, it creates new insights when you watch it.
Yeah. We have to talk about this ending, and we don't have to spend a ton of time here, but this finale, we already mentioned it at the very beginning, Bye Bye Life. Such an incredible, sweeping, emotional number with all of the people in his life. The women are dressed up like parts of his heart, and a singer that he was watching on TV in the hospital room is now in front of him, and this is his death throw, I guess.
Yeah, so one of the things that I picked up on when I was watching it for this is the few times he's watching this like telephone or whatever it is in his hospital room, he keeps like making fun of it and they keep shutting it off before they show who the guest is.
Yeah.
And to me, like on this last watch, my reading of it is like, I think he's like low key a little jealous that he's like, A, telethons are like below him and his art, but B, like he's not a humanitarian. He's not like a great person that this host keeps talking about, like in terms of the guests that are coming on the show. So I think he's like low-key like, whatever, this is beneath me, but also I'm low-key kind of like jealous that I haven't been invited on yet. And then at the very end, like, we go back to this, but now we're in dream, subjective, other world, deathbed space. But we're in this show. And the introduction to Joe Gideon is like, I forget what it is exactly, but it's something like, I barely know him. He's definitely not a humanitarian, but here he is, Joe Gideon. And yeah, it's, I mean, it's amazing. Like, it, like, when I watched, the things I cry at are so weird and wacky, but this is a scene that, like, I cry during. Yeah. Because, yeah, it's about, again, going back to what I said before, it's like about a man who wants control and ultimately realizes he has no control. And that's so true for all of us. And then the song itself, just like the concoction of the song and the dance and the people in the audience and it, the edit and all of it just like hits something deep in my brain. That's like, emotion.
Honestly, I wept openly when I was watching this, and it surprised me too, because I'm not a big crier in movies. I feel like, similar to you, I cry at the weirdest stuff. And I felt so, in a way, silly, but released when I was crying during this final scene, because it's a lively musical number with a lot of dancing and choreography, and he's smiling and everyone's smiling and everyone's happy, and the women from his childhood when he performed in vaudeville, or not vaudeville, but, like, you know, a smaller stage,
burlesque.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. When he performed as a child, or as a young man, the topless women are in the audience that he remembered.
Yeah, they're naked. They're just chilling without shirts on.
And they're smiling, and they're so excited about his performance, and his family's there, and his ex-wife looks up at him, and I love the look that she gives him. She sticks out her tongue a little bit, which feels like an inside joke, or just a little moment. But every single person in this audience on the stage, they're all happy, and I am just weeping openly on my couch. And it, the achievement of creating something like that and having it affect the audience, me at least as the audience, that deeply, I was really floored by the contrast of that.
John Lithgow, we didn't talk about John Lithgow, but he plays like an up and coming, or like a on the rise director. Yeah. Who's like literally trying to get Gideon's job. Anyway, he's in the audience, and they give each other like a curt handshake, but you can tell from Roy Scheider's performance, like, it's okay. I know you were trying to get my job, but it's fine. I like you too.
Yeah.
He's just forgiving everybody.
Yeah. He's forgiving all the producers who had a conversation in the boardroom about, you know, they were like, well, if he dies, we make money, kind of like, yeah, the musical, The Producers. Wallace Shawn is in one of those scenes, which I was like, Wallace Shawn. And you're right, John Lithgow. So many cameos in this film, and they're all here in the audience forgiving him or having a moment of closure with him. And it's so, there's no loose thread in this final scene.
Love the doctor, like, looks at his watch, because to the doctor, to the former Joe Gideon, that would have been him, like, in the world of his, where he's the person in charge on his sets and in his theater, he would have been like, okay, come on, I have other things to do. And in this world, like, the doctor, who has other patients to see and know their patient is dead, is on the verge of being dead, is like looking at his watch, like, can we get this over with so I can move on to the next patient? Like, I think it's so funny.
That's so true. That's his job, and he's just waiting for the next audition or the next patient. That's so true. And then Roy Scheider is lifted onto this circular stage, and they're singing Bye Bye Life, Bye Bye Happiness, Hello Loneliness. It's also joyous. And then we cut back to Joe traveling down a hospital hallway to meet Jessica Lange at the very end. He's gliding, floating down this long corridor. She's smiling, beautiful, ready to meet him. And then this final shot, Jen, I couldn't believe he left. I can't believe Bob Fosse like left us there, because I was just so destroyed. What is the final shot of this film?
Oh, and then he's dead. He's just in a body bag, and the body, all the music cuts out, and we just see he's in a body bag, and the body bag's being zipped up. And it's fucking great. It's so funny. It's so darkly funny. I mean, this whole movie, I love the whole movie because it's has this dark sense of humor to all of it, too. And it's just the most, like, he, Bob Fosse, like, killed himself because it's funny.
Yeah. Like, that's, like, it's so true. It's true. No, you're right. Yeah. That is the beauty of this film. It has so much sense of humor about itself. When that final shot, you just see part of him, his face, and they're just zipping up the body bag around him, and we zoom in and cut to black. And I actually, in the midst of like wiping my face, wiping the tears from my face, I just, I like guffawed out loud.
So actually, I'm pretty sure it's movement. The camera is pulling Joe Gideon back as he's coming towards Jessica Lange, Angelique, Angel of Death. It's like pulling him back, and the music is rising, and he's like, we're deep in this moment of pure emotion, and he's finally giving in, and he's gonna go to heaven. And then it's just a hard cut, and then I'm pretty sure it's just static. It's just dead. Nothing. No sound, no camera movement, just man in a body bag. You barely see his face. Sound of a zipper, cut to black.
Yeah.
Like, the music is over. The show is over. This man is dead. Have a nice day. And then what's the song that comes up at the end over the credits? It's the Ethel Merman song.
There's no business like show business.
Yeah. Fucking funny. Like,
it is.
It's hilarious.
No, it's so funny. It's like the big joke on all of us watching the film, because it is so theatrical. His life is theatrical, but his death is so much more theatrical, and it's sweeping, and it's cinema, and then he just leaves us with this beautifully humble, hilarious, true moment of, you're just a body in a bag, and that's it. And then it's almost like when that final shot cuts out and it cuts to black, it's the biggest joke on all of us, because, I mean, we will all die. And it's kind of a relief to see such a master tell the story of his own death with such a sense of humor. I don't know. It takes the pressure off in a weird way.
Yeah. Everybody dies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just in closing, what really has stayed with you from this film that you've filtered into your own work? I can kind of end our conversation there and open it out to your work. How has this influenced your own work?
Oh my gosh. That's actually a huge question, but I'll try to keep it short, which I guess I really like how subjective this film is. And I want to make something super subjective. And it's so far filtered into my own work in terms of things that I've written. And I'm really hopeful / excited for when I get to direct something that gets to play with the subjective in the way that this movie plays. Not in the same way, but in its own way, but taking a cue from how this movie plays with the subjective.
Mm. Great answer. Well, Jen, thank you so much for spending this time with me. I loved diving into this film, discovering this film for the first time. Thank you so much for your insights.
Thank you, Emily. This was a lot of fun, and I'm glad we got to nerd out about all that jazz.
The Tower is a Glass Eye Picks production. The show is created and hosted by me, Emily Bennett. The show is produced by Jordan Goss-Poure. Technical advisor is Justin Brooks. Sound engineering by Mark Bush. Original music for The Tower was composed by Graham Resnick. Additional music provided by Epidemic Sound. Art by Steak Mountain. See you next time.
Let's talk groceries, specifically your groceries, with Instacart. You want your groceries just the way you like them, right? Well, the Instacart app lets you do just that. They have a new preference picker that lets you pick how ripe or unripe you want your bananas. Shoppers can see your preferences up front, helping guide their choices. Instacart. Get groceries just how you like.
Planning to move? With Pods Moving and Storage, the price we quote is the price you pay. Just choose the container size you want delivered and pack at your own pace. When you're ready, we'll take it to your new home or store it at a secure Pod storage center until you need it. No surprise costs and no deposit necessary. Just more control, more certainty, more value. Book your container today and see why Pods earned 4.8 out of 5 stars on Google in 2025. Visit pods.com today.